Well, hello, everyone. It is 4 o'clock, so we are getting our panel started, and it's my pleasure to get to welcome you. Welcome to We Were There, the 1999 Lexington Fairness Ordinance. We are getting ready for a really special treat. We're going to get to spend an hour together with folks who were eyewitnesses, firsthand accounts of how Lexington passed one of the most comprehensive LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinances in the country when it passed in 1999. As I was just telling the panel, if you look at the Herald Leader printed to announce this ordinance passing 20 years ago, if you flip it open, you'll see a story where Washington, D.C. failed to do what Lexington did 20 years ago at the same time. Lexington was really on to something special in the summer of 1999. Like the passage of the Fairness Ordinance today, it really took a diverse group. And that's what we have here. We have Lexington activists, we have city agencies, we have elected officials who came together to protect, for the first time, Kentuckians from discrimination in employment, in housing, in public accommodations. Our panel today has happened only because of a lot of cooperation and community support. And before we get started, I want to thank those sponsors. Today's event was funded by the Local History Trust Fund grant, administered by the Kentucky Historical Society. I'm very happy to see Dr. Amanda Higgins here. She administers that grant. So next winter, when you're filling out your state taxes, check the box. Give a few dollars to the Local History Trust Fund grant. They support not only programs like this today, but a plethora of wonderful local history programs throughout the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Also, thanks to Allegra Printing that generously donated its services, and to Just Fund Kentucky, whose seed money last year made the commemoration efforts this year a possibility. These generous donors help support the efforts of a group of nonprofits that came together to bring you a series of celebrations. That includes the Lexington History Museum, Lexington Fairness, the Lexington Public Library, and the Faulkner Morgan Archive. As part, you'll see the exhibit Our Fair City, which is across the hallway in the library gallery. The second panel in our series, which is exactly 2 weeks from today, where we will continue this conversation, considering the impact that fairness has had over the past 20 years and how we move towards greater equality. It's wonderful to see such a crowd. It's wonderful to see so many supporters, especially some of our public officials. I see Judge Julie Goodman there. Thank you for coming. And of course, I see Vice Mayor Isabel Yates here in the crowd, who was one of our major supporters 20 years ago. Thank you for your continued support of the community. We really do appreciate that. We are thrilled to have this robust panel assembled here to share their experiences of the passage in 1999. Let me introduce them. Farthest away from me, we have Priscilla Fogle Johnson. Priscilla is a noted Kentucky civil rights advocate, serving as a chair of the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights for 8 years, where she helped to establish the Kentucky Civil Rights Hall of Fame. In 1999, she was the chair of the Lexington Human Rights Commission. Under her leadership, we have some fans back there, the commission unanimously voted to recommend the adoption of a citywide non-discrimination ordinance and really jump-started the passage of the Fairness Ordinance here in Lexington. Her advocacy work has empowered young students, women, voters, and for over a decade, she has been the Director of Minority Affairs at the Administrative Office of the Courts. Thank you for joining us today, Priscilla. Beside her, we have Mayor Linda Gordon. Linda had recently taken her seat on the council, representing the city's 4th district in 1999 when the Fairness Ordinance was presented to the council. When approached by ordinance advocates like Deborah Hensley, very early on in the campaign, Linda was always eager to listen, to learn the details, and she came out strongly supporting the ordinance. Linda, a registered nurse, would go on to serve her district on the council for several terms, eventually becoming vice mayor. And earlier this year, in case you're not aware, Linda became the mayor of our city, where she continues to be an advocate for fairness. We also have Dr. Jeff Jones. Jeff was co-chair of Lexington Fairness, a local advocacy group still doing so much good in our city today, that helped spearhead the ordinance in Lexington, and soon after in other Kentucky cities too. In 1999, he became the first gay man appointed to Lexington's Human Rights Commission, and eventually served as the commission's chair. Jeff is now Associate Professor of Health Policy and Community Health at Georgia Southern University and has joined us today all the way from Savannah. Thank you for coming, Jeff. Next, we have Council Member Jennifer Masotti. Jennifer is the 9th District Council Member, holding the seat that she did in 1999 when the Fairness Ordinance came before the Council in July of that year. An early supporter of the ordinance, Jennifer is recognized for her dedication to local governance, recognized by the National Foundation for Women Legislators and the Fayette County Neighborhood Council, who awarded her the Neighborhood Hero Award. Thank you for coming and joining us, Jennifer. And closest to me here, we have Judge Ernesto Scarsone. Ernesto is a Fayette Circuit judge. Prior to being a judge, Ernesto practiced law, and he served in the state legislature for 24 years, being in the state Senate during the 1999 Fairness Ordinance push. A member of the Fairness Ordinance Committee, Ernesto brought decades of legal, political, and activism experience to the passage efforts, including leading the legal team in the landmark case of Wasson v. Commonwealth. And if you'd like to learn more about that, you can check out the historic marker on Water Street. His advocacy work for the LGBTQ community spans decades and a plethora of issues, including helping establish Just Fund Kentucky in 2006. For his dedication to a more equal Kentucky, Ernesto was inducted into the Kentucky Civil Rights Hall of Fame in 2010. Thank you for coming, Ernesto. And I believe we have another council member from 1999 here.
Gloria Martin,
yeah. I thought that. Yeah. Thank you for joining us this morning. So let's give a big round of applause for our panel here today. Thank you all so much for joining us. So before we get to really the meat of the subject, I do have a few housekeeping things I have to go over. First, if you have a cell phone, do make sure that's silenced. Also, do please note that this event is being recorded, just in case you want the camera to get your best side. And to give you the sort of lay of the land, this moderated portion, it'll last about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll have about 20 minutes for Q&A from the audience. For my panelists, when you're speaking, do speak into the microphone, even if the audience can hear you because of the recording. We need to make sure that your mics are pretty close. And with that, I'd like to start really with sort of a broad question to set the tone of the panel. Issues?
Yeah.
And so for each of you, I'd like to sort of give you an opportunity to kind of briefly answer this first question. The five of you, you really approached the Fairness Ordinance in 1999 from different positions, from different identities, right, both queer and straight, city activists and city officials, you know, sometimes even blurring those lines. So I expect the way you all answer this question will differ, too. If you're thinking back before the passage of the Fairness Ordinance in 1999, can you recall the moment when you first realized the need for something like a Fairness Ordinance? Can you recall the first time you were made aware, right, of a push for a Fairness Ordinance? And let's start with you, Priscilla, and we'll just work our way down the line.
Great. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
You know, as I was the chair for in 1999 of the Lexington Human Rights Commission, and I was appointed by Mayor Pam Miller, but I will say it was 1993 when we really was getting complaints coming into the commission that gay population was being discriminated in various aspects of their life. So to be honest, we started documenting informal complaints during that time of 1993.
Right. And so without an ordinance, I assume the informal record keeping was all your agency could do.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Linda.
Well, I was a brand new council member in 1999, from January, started my very first term. And quite honestly, I was fairly naive and fairly uneducated. And so Carolyn Braugh and Patty Cooper brought the ordinance to, they were both friends, and Carolyn was a neighbor. And I met Patty through our work with Friends of the Dog Park. And so they brought the ordinance to me to educate me. And so we spent a good bit of that spring into June, and they were going through the ordinance little by little to help me understand what was in it and what it meant. And you would think, being a nurse, I should have known more than I did, but I didn't. And so they helped me understand. And really, the moment that I knew for sure that we needed this was when I heard all the horrible, ugly, disgusting prejudice expressed at those hearings. I'm curious, how many of you were there?
Wow.
Lots of you.
When we titled We Were Here, you all really took that to heart.
So
you all were there, yeah.
You remember how terrible it was. And I had never heard people treat each other that way. I grew up in a family that didn't yell at each other and that didn't do what happened those two nights. And I'll never forget Gloria Martin sat there and said, well, this just shows why we need this. Oh, goodness.
Jeff.
When I moved here in 1991, I already knew that the U.S. and Kentucky did not have a law. And so from the first time I got to Kentucky and worked with UK Lambda and everything.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Can you all hear me now?
Oh.
I knew that we did not have a law. In fact, even today I saw a report last week that 45% of Americans believe that anti-gay discrimination or discrimination based on gender identity is already illegal. But it's not. It's illegal here in Lexington because 20 years ago, many of the four women and more in this room voted to make our city more welcoming. I live in Savannah now. We do not have a law there. We do not have a state law. The U.S. does not have a law. I know many people who are afraid to get married, even today, because they're afraid that if they get legally married, they will lose their jobs. I wish that my co-chair from that time could be on this stage, but she recently took a state job in Frankfurt, and she is afraid that if she was here, her job would be at risk. And mm-hmm. she is an amazing lady.
Yeah.
So I have known that we needed this law since I first passed into this beautiful bluegrass place. And any gay people I've known or groups I've worked with, GLSO, UK Lambda, eventually Lexington Fairness, if you were gay, you knew people who had been discriminated against, and you knew that they had no legal recourse. And many Americans still believe we are protected and we are not.
Mm-hmm. Hi, thank you for being here this evening. Can you hear me? I grew up in upstate New York in a city called Syracuse, and very diverse. You know, we had the Irish section, we had the Polish section, we had the Italian, the Jewish, the white, the black, the gay, the straight. So I kind of grew up with a little bit of a different background and was exposed to a lot of different things. And so when I was approached by Dr. Brott and Deborah Hensley about the Fairness Ordinance, I didn't think much about it except this is the right thing to do. You just don't treat anybody any differently because why should you? So I guess I was an early yes from the very beginning. And again, like Mayor Gorton said, that night was a true eye-opener. I can remember like it was yesterday, just the terrible things that were said. We were condemned to hell. We were going to burn. We were just, we were ugly. Every terrible thought came out of terrible ideas, and it was sad. And as Linda paraphrased what Gloria said, now more than ever, we need this ordinance. And I was so proud after that evening to have been a part of that because it was just, again, the right thing to do. And look at what we've done because of that. So mm-hmm. we are so fortunate that we've made this milestone here in Lexington.
I self-identified as gay in 1978 and immediately started working with then GSO. And it was obvious that there wasn't fair treatment for our community. But don't forget, we were still criminals at the time. And it was just the fight started in 86 and didn't finish in 92. So first we had to get the sodomy statute out of the way, and then we could start dealing with things like employment and housing and everything else and accommodations. And then we were looking at Louisville because Louisville started earlier, you know, in 91. We had some petitions here at Fayette County even before 99, but I mean, as an organized community-wide effort, it was not till 99. And Louisville started earlier. We saw what was happening there. And they forced the issue early, didn't do very well. They lost three times, you know, when they finally brought it up in 99. So timing was important. And I think we felt in 99 that we could pull it off and that Lexington was ready and that we had a progressive mayor, progressive council, and that the timing and the country had dramatically improved on this issue. So we thought it was the time to strike.
Gotcha. And Ernesto, that's actually the perfect segue into the next question, which is for you. So you came, right, into the fight for a fairness ordinance already with a great amount of experience from your legislative work, from your activism, you know, getting groups to come together, right, to perform some action. And you had mentioned you had watched the Louisville Fairness Ordinance and its very long trek to passage. So I'm interested, how exactly did you and your colleagues develop the strategy that was used in 1999? You know, what were the past experiences you were able to draw on? What were the particular strengths you were able to build? What were the challenges that you found in Lexington that influenced your tactics?
Well, first of all, we should say this was a very collaborative effort, okay? All the work, just about everybody in this room was involved in the effort. We all worked together. And there was a lot of, you know, good spirit, I think. Everybody did work together. I had the committee and all the names and all the responsibilities. It was a good feeling working together. We knew that to make a good sales pitch for this, we had to know our audience. So we had to talk to the people that were going to be doing this and say, how do we approach it? How do you want it to be approached? And, you know, Deborah was a wonderful conduit to the mayor because not only were they friends, but she was the campaign manager for Mayor mm-hmm. Miller. And I know what campaign managers' relationships to the candidates are. That's good. That's great. So, but more so, and Isabel Yates, vice mayor, I mean, was absolutely wonderful in many, many ways. But dealing with strategy, you know, they did not want a repeat of what happened in Louisville, which was this very divisive, bitter wrangling that lasted many years. And so I think the advice that we got was, one, we want a short window of time for this issue to come up and be voted on. And so the idea was to do it close to the recess so that the council was getting ready to go out on recess. We didn't want a lot of time, didn't want an opportunity to drag it out.
Mm.
No, that was one of the strategies, okay? Two, to help the legitimacy of this issue, we wanted it to come, I don't say we, I mean the mayor and the vice mayor said, we want it to come from the Human Rights Commission. Mm. That gave it the aura of even further legitimacy. It wasn't an advocacy group, a lobbying group, or a single council purpose, but it was the body that talks about human rights, and they say we need it. That's what was suggested. Then the other thing is to avoid what happens in so many cities. You present an imperfect ordinance or one that hasn't been fleshed out very well, and you delay it because you have to send it to committee, send it to the law department. So get it worked out before we introduce it. And so then Dennis Stutzman, who's not here, but did a wonderful job as a legal talent in trying to work with the law department. Now, Isabel Yates got the law department to work with us. Now, had she not done that, the law department couldn't just be spending all their time working with this lobbying group. So that was key. And then we started hearing feedback about what might be problems. Bathrooms, dressing codes, religious exemptions. So let's work these out before we even go public with the ordinance so that we don't have any more hurdles, any more barriers to get this a quick vote. So we worked out language to deal with these particular issues before. And then we talked to people. We had some wonderful supporters. And we want to make sure with all the one-on-ones, and so many people here were involved with the one-on-ones with their, you know, we identified which council members talked to and so forth. And then also, we wanted to make it easier for those who might be wavering by showing community support for it. And so we polled. We spent money to do a poll. Lonnie Otis fortunately still kept the wording of the poll and everything. and to say that, you know, which was true, 75% of Lexingtonians were okay with this, you know. So we thought that helped. And then, of course, we had wonderful presenters that brought the issue up. So that was kind of the points. It all came from the council suggesting this is how you should present it to us.
Wow. Yeah. So obviously a lot of forethought, right? Really thought it through. So on the surface, it seemed seamless, quick, easy kind of thing. But in reality, right, there had been a lot of work behind the scenes. Yeah.
I mean, we had a progressive mayor. I mean, let's face it. Louisville, you know, all the rumors about Jerry Abrams, he didn't want to deal with this gay issue, you know. Pam didn't have that worry, you know. And we had a progressive council. In Louisville, they called for that first vote when they didn't have the support, and it entrenched people. You know, as a politician, if you're forced to vote on a difficult issue, once you vote on it, it's tough to go back. You know, you've got your friends and your enemies because of how you did it. And then if you switched, you know, yeah, you've ruined your support with your supporters, you know. And then the enemy likes you, but they don't trust you because if you switch votes. So it's in Louisville, they had to switch votes and get new people elected. In Lexington, we hadn't forced the issue before. So it was a novel issue, and it was creating an environment that made it comfortable for what we knew were progressive people to vote.
Right. And I'm so glad you mentioned Dennis and Dennis's work in passing the Fairness Ordinance. Dennis will actually be joining our panel on July 7th, so I look forward to hearing his conversation. I'd like to move down, Priscilla, to you. Ernesto mentioned the role of the Human Rights Commission as the city agency, right, that would go forward and propose the ordinance. What made the Human Rights Commission in 1999 the right city agency? the Human Rights Commission not only proposed the ordinance, but voted for it unanimously when they did so. So how was it so resolute in its support?
Well, John, I have to say, with the Human Rights Commission being involved, we knew then it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was about human rights. It was about them being discriminated. And Jeff Jones was on the commission during that time, and all of our commissioners had the same thought. We need to support this. We had a brilliant lawyer that was our director, William Wharton,
mm-hmm.
and William worked very closely with Senator then Scorsone and Dennis Strautzman and Curlin Brott, and brought all that information to the commission body. And as appointees to the commission, we knew what our job was. We were there to make sure that our folks in our community of the city of Lexington would not be discriminated against. And that's why we were so interested in being behind it.
Wow. The you had mentioned during the first question that the Human Rights Commission was already very much aware of some of these discriminatory
acts
that were happening.
As I indicated, in 1993, we were getting
Six years worth.
But again, we did not have an ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
We really didn't have a setup where that we could actually start making it the law that they couldn't be discriminated against. So therefore, we was just documenting.
Mm-hmm.
And we had those documentations of those complaints that was actually coming in.
Yeah. Just sort of off the top of your head, can you remember any of those complaints? Like, do any of them really sort of stick out or like a general sense? I'm sorry, I know that one's
coming.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. A lot of them was employment.
Oh, okay.
Jeff, I don't know if you can remember, but I do believe that the bulk of them was employment discrimination.
Right. Well, thank
you. And maybe
you.
Some housing. You know, there was public accommodation, I do believe. Mm-hmm. So,
So the those sort of three major areas that the Fairness Ordinance was, you know, very much focused with were already clearly documented issues of discrimination in the city well before 1999 came around. Wow, thank you. The my next question is both for you, Jennifer, and for you, Linda. So you all are coming at this, you know, as elected officials. And in that great piece that was in the Herald Leader earlier this week, you in particular, Mayor, you mentioned the impact that your constituents had in terms of your support, how you thought about it. So how did you two come to decide to support the ordinance, despite knowing, right, that you would have constituents who would be vehemently opposed to your support? And could you describe for us, you've already sort of teased at it, what it was like sitting on the council bench, you know, during those two public hearings, being the ones who got that vote. We'll start with you, Jennifer, if you'd like to take it first.
The head of the Family Foundation lives three streets from me.
So that's close.
There was a little pressure right there from the beginning, and I represent a pretty conservative area, which is the south end of town, so the pressure was pretty intense. And I had a constituent call me and ask me if I would come visit with the Reverend Wayne Smith because he wanted to talk to me about it. And I knew that this was not going to work out well, but I went, and he explained to me what he thought the religious implications would be if I would support this. And, you know, I told him that, you know, I believe that's his viewpoint, but my viewpoint was different. And he also mentioned to me that, you know, my election would be coming up, and I said, I'm well aware of that, but that I felt very strongly that, again, it was so basic to me that this was just the right thing to do, that I didn't give it much thought that it was anything else beyond that. And so Mr., I think it was Ostrander, who was the head of the Family Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
He
I think people in the audience may know that name.
He also met with me and advised me that this would again be the end of my political career. And I think when someone gives me that kind of a challenge. I even take it on a little bit further, and I thought, well, okay, let's just see if it is. So, you know, it was tough. It was a difficult situation. I had, you know, terrible phone calls at home. I had people coming to my door. My kids were young at that time. They were in junior high and elementary school. Things were being said about their mother that weren't very nice. And I just said, well, those aren't very nice people. That's all. And so it, as this kind of all developed, you know, it just made me angrier that I got this kind of response. You know, it was just, it just wasn't right. And so as that evening came on, you know, the council saying is 8 votes, and that's when you get something done. You can kind of tell how you have kind of, you know, to navigate these waters. And we knew it was going to be close. We didn't know how close it would be because, you know, there had to be some amendments that had to be positioned in order for it to go forward. But there was the 8 of us that were pretty solid on this. And we felt like if we could get at least more votes that it would be not easily overturned if case there was a challenge. But, again, it just amazed me at I guess the mean-spiritedness and the hatred that was out there, and I just had never experienced that. And as Linda had alluded, you know, she grew up in a family that didn't experience that, and neither did I, nor did I teach my children to act that way. And so the more that someone would either question why I was doing that or say something that was ugly or, you know, suggest that you're not going to be elected again because of your viewpoints, it made me even more determined. But it was an eye-opener for a night. There's no question, and I could go on and on about it, but I'll let Linda kind of jump in, because we were sitting right next to each other.
We were right next to each other.
I saw her face.
So the job of an elected official is to gather information first, and I believe in this so strongly. I'm a very intentional person. And so I spent a lot of time gathering information and educating myself. And in the article where I think it was it today's paper or yesterday's paper, where the article that had you on the front page, Ernest, Beth Musgrave told a little bit about the dentist who called me at my home. And back then, you know, cell phones weren't, the numbers weren't readily known, so most people called my landline, and this man called my landline, and he said, and I found out later, he lived just around the corner from me, and he's the man who said that he knew where I lived, and he knew where my children went to school, and he said, you're wrong if you vote for this. And I said, well, I was such a naive council member back then. I was in it for all the right reasons. People, the greater good, right? Knew nothing about politics. And I said to him, I was raised to treat people the way I want to be treated. And he started screaming at me, and he said, don't quote the Bible to me. And I really wasn't quoting the Bible. I was just telling him how I was raised. And so it was that kind of thing that was so distressing. I mean, you know, it was, I think of all the votes that we made in those at least the 16 years that I was on the council, that was the most hatred-filled, distressing. I mean, the smoking ordinance was bad, but not that bad. And I was next to Jennifer the night of the vote, and I was literally shaking. Remember that? Because people were so hatred-filled. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. It was a farming community, and I had no idea people could be so hate-filled toward each other. And they didn't even know the people in the room, most of them, right? Mm. It was a prejudice-filled, hate-filled explosion of statements that night, and it was very distressing. But I, you know, it's very character building. to go through something like that. And it's not my job to make all of my constituents happy. It's my job to learn about the issues and look at all sides and what consequences might be and then make an informed decision. And that's what I did. But whoo-hee, it sure helped me, you know, grow some thick skin, I would say. But it was absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah, it sounds like a baptism by fire.
It was. It takes a council member about a year to figure out all, you know, full budget cycle and figure out everything that's going on, and then you throw something like that in. And it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. It seems to have worked out for you, though.
I mean,
it seems as though the re-election campaign and all of that did pretty well. As I was reading about the event, one of the things that struck me was just how long those meetings went. Yeah. If I read correctly, you all voted well into the night.
1:30 in the morning.
1:30 in the morning. Yeah.
We had that same night, we had the pipeline proposal, taking a water pipeline through Woodford County. Do you remember how controversial that was? And we had the rural land management plan.
Second
reading. It was a docket full of important things.
Mm-hmm. I was actually just having dinner a couple of weeks ago with an older gay couple, and I was talking about the ordinance and this upcoming panel. Neither of them are particularly political or activist, anything like that, but both of them recalled standing outside of City Hall and waiting to hear the word sort of leak out that the ordinance had passed, and 20 years later how much that still meant to them to be on Main Street and to hear those words. Yeah,
but John, I will tell you, on that night, Thursday night, July the 8th, when the commissioners were coming out, I have to say, there were so many people in the foyer. They were applauding us when we came out.
Wow.
So it made me feel good knowing that they felt like we were there to really make sure that, you know, all humans would be, you know, subjected to treated equally. But they were applauding us on that Thursday night. And then, of course, on that Friday morning, looking at the Herald Leader, there was a picture of Sammy Miller, and whose father was the chair of the Human Rights Commission early years, and William Wharton. And we still today chuckle because she says, "You was the chair, but I made the front page." The so.
The opponents were providing free hot dogs, if you remember.
Yeah, that's right.
There are people who came to campaign against
us. People was everywhere. Yeah.
They were everywhere. It was packed, remember?
Yeah, as a member of the Faulkner Morgan Archive, you know, we collect, conserve, promote the LGBTQ history of Kentucky. And watching the council hearing video is about 6 hours long, right? Lots and lots of conversation. And something that immediately struck me with the opponents were their very large badges that they were wearing. They were white with a black equal sign. Okay. And so, of course, you know, not being there in 1999, I equate the equal sign with, you know, sort of gay rights, assuming, right, that was the way that the audience was working out. But as soon as they started to get up to speak, I saw that I was wrong. But with the archive, I would love to find one of those big white badges and maybe get a free hot dog, apparently. Yeah, exactly. I might be asking for his address later. I'm friendly enough. I'll just go knock on the door. Speaking of that night, Jeff, I'd like to turn to you. So you're co-chair of Lexington Fairness in 1999. You were a grad student, so a little probably occupied with that too. And it was Lexington Fairness. I mean, you all really, you oversaw so much of the public face of the ordinance support. Looking through some of your papers, which are now at UK, I was so struck by like the complexity of your phone tree. The fact that you all had like 2,000 households you all were calling, sometimes on a weekly and daily basis, you know, y'all were getting, along with your colleagues, your co-chair, right, getting folks out to march in the July 4th parade, filling the council chambers, calling their council members. So you really sort of had a sense of the pulse, right, of the broader LGBTQ community and its allies, its supporters. So what was the mood of the broader community while this push was occurring? And what was it like, right, both as one of the organizers, but also as a gay person yourself, right, to see that ordinance pass? That's a big question. Yeah.
In my short 29 years,
it was you a were nine experience. At this?
I was only nine at the time, so I was really excited at the time.
Overachiever.
It was a wonderful time. It was hard work. Many of you in this room worked there, as Ernesto mentioned. This was a collaborative effort. How many of you worked on the ordinance? Raise your hand.
Wow.
In some way or the other, yes. So many of y'all were there, not for that short couple of weeks, but for 6 months or more.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting every night after your full-time job. Working on that phone tree, working on flyers, working on polls, working on legal language. It was a lot of work. And so the article in the Herald Leader was wonderful. But it kind of seemed to say, you know, people got together, and 2 weeks later we had an ordinance.
Yeah.
But as Ernesto and folks kind of have alluded to as well, there was a lot of preparation, a lot of learning built on years of work in politics, in government, in civil rights work, in phone trees. If Linda West had not called, probably many of you in this room, and built that phone list for years after years, or updating it, we may not have had the ordinance that we have, or the public face. So there are, you know, a lot of times you hear the LGBT community, but there are many communities. They overlap sometimes, sometimes they don't. Everything from, you know, lesbian attorneys to drag queens to college students to transgendered people. We are many different kinds of lives. And what I remember from that time, and I tried to think of things that are applicable today, because it's kind of a dark time. There's a lot of fear that what we have built can be taken away.
That's right.
And if you look at history of our community, because I have, and have written on it, it's a cycle. The 70s, many of the ideas that we have today were brought forward in the 70s. In the 80s were a dark time with HIV and some of the politics. And in the 90s, it was a wonderful time. All kinds of new things like the ordinance happened. Then we also know that like the marriage amendments were passed in the early 2000s. And then 9 years later, people can get married. So it is a cycle. And what I remember from that time are that today we like to think, wow, we all got along and it was a wonderful time. But people argued. People argued at our meetings. People argued in our community. They had different ideas of what they wanted. But they kept their eye on the prize. And they worked together through those arguments. They didn't, in most cases, did not walk away. And they stayed to make sure that everything worked. And I think that is a lesson for us today, that we may come from different perspectives, but we have to work together. That we are different communities with different perspectives. Some people also felt that at that time that Fairness was a radical group of kind of too out in the face. Some people did not want to be seen. They were afraid for their professional image. Other people did step forward. And then after the ordinance passed, people who were afraid to work with Fairness suddenly started working with it. So there has been a change in our community. We have become more respectable even in politics. And today, we sit with the mayor and judges and city council people to celebrate this. But this was not the way it was 20 years ago. And so today, I would say, we're in a cycle. Things will get better. We will disagree. We will, coalitions will have to form. Keep those mailing lists going. Mm-hmm. Of course, now there'll be email lists.
Yeah.
Maybe Snapchat, who knows. But these are the lessons that I learned. That the biggest lesson I learned, and I learned from listening to people in our community, angry, frustrated, hurt. Many of them had a lot of terrible stories of the things that they had faced, and they didn't understand why people just wouldn't vote for this without being listening. Many people wanted, like your dentist, to scream at the city council people. But what I remember is that you had to tell everybody, you privately vent to each other. But when you go speak to the city council members, when you speak to the public, you have to keep your eye on the prize. You have to speak politely. And you have to keep working, even if you're angry at people. But it was also important to have somebody to vent to. Because if you did not, you couldn't do the public work. If you didn't have people that you could go and say, oh my God, I just want to like stab them in the face. But these are the realities of working for change.
Yeah.
That we all have emotions. City council people have emotions. And it is nice to be civil and polite, even to the people. One thing I recall is while many people did stand up and say negative things, people from the opposition, you would hold the door for them, they would hold the door for you. And that was something that made me proud of Lexington, is the civility that people showed. Even if some people did get hot, they did say mean things, all of us probably in our lifetimes have heard people say some pretty nasty things. But I hope that our city has come forward in 20 years. We know today that there's always work to be done. And you're going to be angry, and you need to vent. But then you have to keep your eye on the goal. And among the gay community, I heard many voices, different voices, people who were angry, people who wanted to be courted. We were working often 5 or 6 days a week on this. And they're like, we might come join y'all, but we want you to come to a couple of our meetings and talk to us and stuff. And we're like, we don't have time. Please come and be part of our coalition. I had other people who said, I will come and work, but I don't want endless meetings. I sat through endless meetings in the 80s and 90s working about consensus and whether we should have styrofoam or paper cups. I will come and work if there is a detailed, focused effort. And so these are where people are. Some people just want to work on specific things. Other people want you to put their issues in the forefront and to be courted. And sometimes you don't have that. Sometimes you have to go there, work with the styrofoam cups, not stab people in the face, go home and write in your journal how angry you are, and keep your eye on the prize. And I think our community did that because we had leadership from different people, Carolyn Brott, Ernesto, Deborah, Fee, all of these people who stepped forward, who paid the bills like Jim did, who looked at the polls and kept the numbers like Melanie, who stuffed all those envelopes because it was the early days of the internet. So what I found is I would say there's diversity in our community, diversity of thought, people who were afraid, people who were not afraid, but people kept their eye on the prize, and we did it. And afterwards, I was telling Fee earlier, that the most meaningful thing of that night is some young people came up to us afterwards and said, I have never thought I belonged. I have never voted. Yeah. And I'm going to vote because I feel finally I belong in this city.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. And Jeff, you really set me up for my next question. You were talking about, right, thinking about the lessons that are applicable to today. You made a brief mention, right, to darker times, to fear of things being taken away, but also of lasting impact, right? 20 years ago, there were young folks who voted, right, and who are probably still voting now, right, feeling as though they belong, right? This is part of their community. And just as we begin, this will be my last question before we open it up to the public. Our next panel on July 7th is going to look specifically at that 20-year legacy, right? What has happened since 1999, since the ordinance has passed, and what are the challenges that we're still facing today? So in a brief sentence or two, I'd like each of you to really sum up what you see, right? If you had to cut it down to a sentence, to two sentences, which I'm making you do, what would you see as the legacy of the Fairness Ordinance? And we'll start with Priscilla like we did last time. We'll work down.
Okay. Well, I will say that, inclusion makes us stronger. And with that, I say to those folks that's here today and here at the panel, we must continue to keep on marching for freedom rights and human rights, and also make sure that we continue to let folks know the importance of voting and voting and voting the right persons, our people, that, you know, certainly that will, you know, represent us as a whole. Yeah. So
I think that the legacy is that for Lexington to have a fairness ordinance says that we are welcoming, we want diversity, and quite honestly, in the straight community, people don't even think about it anymore, which is, for that part of our community, a good thing, right? But I think it's the message that we say to the world, that we want you, we want diversity, and we're not going to discriminate against you.
Jeff?
I would say Linda's message is the big one, that you belong, that this is a welcome community, no matter the color of your skin or your hair, whether you have tattoos, if you vote one way or you vote the other, who you pray to, or if you don't pray at all, you are welcome here. And that is the larger message. The other message I think it sends is that all the people 20 years ago who did this work stood on the shoulders of all the people who have been here before, that we remember or don't remember, from Sweet Evening Breeze and the people before him to the people who stand on our shoulders, like my granddaughter Tuesday back there, who's the new chair of Lexington Fairness. So the people also, it sends a message, if there is change to be in the future, we did it, you can do it, and you won't be alone. You have a history.
Pretty simple. If you believe in what you're doing, you know, if you believe it's right, just do it. I don't think there's anyone here on this panel or anyone in the audience that feels that they have a strong conviction of something that they believe truly in their heart is the right thing that to do, they would do it. And if we could just go on like that as a country and continue to do things that we think is for the benefit of everyone, not just one specific person, we'd be better off. So, again, I guess in my case, it was easy for me to make that decision that night. I thought it was the right thing to do. I believed it was a better thing for our city and for our country, and obviously it sent a strong message that we did the right thing that night. And hopefully we'll continue to do that as a nation, because we've got a lot of work ahead of us to go.
I think laws and court decisions are limited in changing behavior. I mean, they don't do the whole thing, you know, but they go a long way to setting standards and norms and giving messages to the community about what is right and what isn't right. And it was a very important message to make 20 years ago, to tell the whole community we need to treat these folks in our city fairly. And that's pretty powerful. I think the lasting thing is the act of courage, to be honest with you, by people like Jennifer Masati, Mayor Gordon, Gloria Martin, and Isabel Yates. I mean, because they faced down the pressure and the nasty calls and messages, and they did the right thing. And acting in a courageous way, it speaks volumes for everybody, because it inspires other people to be courageous for whatever question they may have to deal with, you know. And for our community, it was incredibly empowering to see the political system respond favorably to something we asked for. You know, it really was. It made us all feel so proud to be in Lexingtonian, but also that we can do this. And if we've tackled this successfully, then maybe there's other things that we could do down the road. And it really was. It was very empowering to watch that whole process.
Wow. Thank you all. I hope on July 7th that I'll be able, you know, to bring up some of these ideas as we think about that legacy. And it's fascinating to see the similarities in some of your answers, right? Things like you belong, right? You're welcomed here, right? You're included. You don't have to worry, right? You have
a system of government, right? You have a city that's going to protect you. And that matters. You know, in 1999, I was, you know, a young queer boy growing up in Goodman Holler in Pike County, right? And what you all were doing in 1999 affects me in 2019 in very profound ways. And I thank you all for that. It matters. Thank you. Well, we're going to ask Jeff Jones' granddaughter, Tuesday Meadows, how in the world...
I'm so proud. Proud.
That is some really weird finagling that Tuesday would be Jeff's granddaughter. Tuesday's going to play our Vanna White. We want to open it up. We have about 15, 20 minutes for questions from the audience. And so Tuesday will come with you. She'll have the microphone there. Who would like to start? Yeah, just raise your hand. We have one.
Actually, you know, you brought, Kenny, you brought to mind something I'd sort of forgotten. I don't know if this is true for Jennifer and others, but through the whole process, I talked a lot by phone to different council members. We were pinging ideas off of each other, and sometimes 11 o'clock at night, I would get a call from another council member. Well, what do you think about this part of it? And what do you think about this? And so if anything, for me personally, it really cemented some relationships with other council members. There were three who voted no, as we all know. And that was a little difficult to understand totally why. But for me, actually, it did cement some relationships because we were talking constantly about this. It was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be sure we understood, you know, where we were and what are your ideas and what do you think about this part and et cetera. And so it was good that way.
I've got a quick story that I'm going to tell on the vice mayor. It was the morning of the evening for the ordinance, and she called me and said that she wanted to go to lunch, and she said, "I'll come pick you up, darling." So she comes to my office, and the next thing you know, the vice mayor has been announced that she's at my office to go pick me up, and we go right down the street to the Applebee's, and I could tell she was stressed. She probably had a lot more pressure on her from the religious community than a lot of us did. And maybe being just a tad bit older, I think she probably had a group that maybe didn't feel as understanding or as open to this idea of an ordinance. And we walk into the Applebee's on Richmond Road, and out of the speaker is playing Bruce Springsteen's song Philadelphia, and she's saying, "My word, this is more than I thought this was going to happen." I said, "Isabel, this is an omen." I said, "Look, hear what they're playing," and she said, "Oh my goodness!" And I'll never forget that. And her face was just like she just kind of relaxed. And just those, as Linda said, those relationships, it made a lot of us stronger because the pressure was so hard for us to try to make the right decision, because there was always someone saying, "Well, let's make an amendment about this," or "Let's try to make this work so we can make sure that we get this passed." And there was also our, you know, our council members who did not support it, who we respected, but we had to understand that they, for either religious reasons or whatever, did not support this either. And we knew that we'd be working with them down the road. So it it really solidified your relationships on the council. But I just wanted to tell that little story about the vice mayor, because she was a true leader at this, and so was Gloria. I mean, Gloria never wavered. I mean, you know Gloria. She makes a decision, and that's it. There's never any questions. This is it. Let's go. And I thank the two of you, because you were very supportive with the rest of us that made this happen.
I wonder if I could add something about the vice mayor. But if you recall 20 years ago when these ordinances were being considered, there was a big issue as to whether transgender folks were going to be included in the ordinance or not. And I remember it was the vice mayor, because we talked to her, and because she had had a good sense of what the council was capable of doing, so but also offered leadership. And when she looked at the issue and she realized transgender folks were getting, you know, maltreated more than anybody else, you know, and they should be included in this ordinance. And it was her strength about the transgender issue and her sense that it could be included in the ordinance that really made it so, you know, quite frankly. So I think for that part of the ordinance, I really, Isabel Yates, you were wonderful, and we really appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah, as a historian, you know, looking exactly what the ordinance covered, how inclusive it was compared to cities that were much larger who simply could not wrestle out an ordinance like that, it's so impressive. And Vice Mayor, Council Member Martin, when you're in the exhibit, make sure you watch that video so you get to hear their takes of that evening as well. Another question. Oh, good afternoon, Mark.
Thank you for the memories, and thanks for all your hard work. It's appreciated. This is for Priscilla in particular. Did you get any kind of response, or what response did you get from the African-American community?
You know, Mark Johnson, it's good to see you. To be very honest, I want to say that the African-American community was not resistant for us doing it. I think that, again, as I indicated, with respect to human rights and freedom rights, I think that they were saying, okay, it's a human rights issue. We make sure that they're not discriminated against. You know, discrimination is wrong. And I will say, you know, just as we have laws on the book, you know, they can easily change back. So that's why we must continue to advocate and continue to be out there and get folks elected who certainly will support, you know, the cause. Thank you.
And I'm glad you bring that up. When you go to the exhibit, you'll see a timeline, and there is a photograph taken in Greenwich Village in New York City in 1965, and there is a man at a bar. He's being refused service because he's an open homosexual. And that was legal in New York at the time. And this man, his name was Dick Leisch, and he went there to that bar on purpose, declared he was a homosexual, he wanted to be served, and when he wasn't, he refused to leave until he was. Dick Leisch was from Kentucky, and he developed that very, it's considered to be one of the first sort of public civil rights movements by an openly gay person. And he took that idea exactly from Kentucky's black civil rights movement, right? Of course, it would take a Southerner, right, a Kentuckian, to understand it's a sit-in, right? And at Julius's, he called it a sip-in. And today, if you go to Julius's, which is still a gay bar just a block away from the Stonewall in Greenwich Village, right behind the bar, right, you will see a photograph of Dick Leisch, right here from Kentucky. Yeah.
Can I mention something about Robert Jefferson, African-American council member at the time? Mm-hmm. And Dennis Dussman will tell you that in working out the language, you know, one of the concessions we had to make was a religious exemption. And Robert Jefferson was just so upset about that exemption. He says, that's what they used against African Americans to say religion, you know, religious people could do this, you know. So he didn't care much for that exemption, but he realized the politics of it, that it had to go. But you know, he was a leader. He's been a human rights activist, civil rights activist for a long time.
Yeah. Another.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Do you all mind giving us a few names of some of those allies who, yeah?
Episcopalian Church was pretty strong. Yes. Support. The bishop came, yes. Yeah. Episcopalian bishop had come.
Rex Van Alstine and the MCC Church, of course, were supporters. There were members from the Unitarian Universalist Church that were there. Who is head of the, is it like the Federation of Churches, a lady?
Nancy Jo Kemper.
Yes.
Yep.
She
testified
in favor of the ordinance. So there were a number of...
The bishop from the Episcopalian Church, I just can't recall the name.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Bonnie Quantrill was a minister then, but she certainly, I remember her speaking at the microphone. We had a lot of support from the religious community. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes.
That's right.
It looks like we have time for one more question. Who's going to be the lucky one? Oh, there we go.
I'll pick on Isabel for a minute. And at some point, you invited me. It was either the election night party or your inauguration party. I can't remember which one. At your home, and getting ready that evening, you know, not exactly the evening gown type black tie hair or anything like that. And I made the decision to pull on my black T-shirt with the white letters, fairness, no more, no less. And she took a look at my shirt, greeted me, took me by the hand, and said, "Come with me," and took me to her whole house, introducing me as my good friend, Judy Smith.
Wow. That is, that's a wonderful way to end our panel, right? That's what it takes, right? It takes those allies, it takes those supporters, it takes that community to bring us forward. So as we end, you know, I want to thank again our panelists today, our sponsors, our organizers, and let's continue this conversation in 2 weeks. At 4 p.m. right here on July 7th, we will have our second panel in the series, Where Are We Now? Fairness in 2019, discussing the impact of the Fairness Ordinance over the last 20 years and contemplate how we move our city, how we move our state towards greater equality for all. And, of course, let's continue the conversation today, too. Right across the hallway, go and see our new exhibit, Our Fair City, the Fairness Ordinance of 1999. We have a reception there, thanks to the Lexington History Museum. So enjoy the exhibit. Make sure that you thank our panelists and our sponsors while you do so. And thank you all for coming out. It's a great day.